So here we are. We are here at the time when I sit down and you stand up. So I welcome anyone who feels so moved to come forward.
Get it over with first. I had a vision. I had a vision. It wasn't a Saul on the road to Damascus kind of a vision, but it was a vision. It came at a time of mostly positive change in our young family, but with some upheaval as well. Our third daughter was born 20 months after the birth of our second, and 3 months later, for business reasons, we moved from Burlington to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Our second and middle child was a sweet and very placid baby, but by 18 months, she was already showing signs of a strong and assertive personality. The dramatic change in family circumstances and the loss of all that was familiar and comfortable to her no doubt helped to catapult her into a terrible two phase of exponential proportions. Terrible to the power of 50. My sister, who then lived in Boston, later called it this daughter's Linda Blair period, as in The Exorcist. We had and still have this challenging child of mine, a strong bond. I tried very hard and mostly succeeded to be calm and patient with her through temper tantrums and flights of negative emotion that punctuated our family life at that time. One night, after a particularly difficult evening, when I had finally calmed her into sleep, I sat on the edge of her bed and looked down on this tear-stained, beloved little face and felt a piercing moment of real despair. I thought, I don't know, is this a child of light or is this a child of darkness? And what do I do if it's the latter? But right then, I was gifted with a flick of a picture, a vision. I saw with clarity that was unmistakably and undeniably true, my daughter in the future. I saw her as a woman about the same age that I am now, and the center, the linchpin, the focal point of a strong, happy, loving, extended family. The vision assured me she was going to be okay. The thing about visions, whether biblical or modern, is they carry with them a sense of utter conviction. That momentary picture was so strong, so true, that I never once doubted it. It served to guide my parenting of this child all through her childhood and adolescence, which were challenging. It was a vision, after all, and not a miracle. But what a gift to never have a doubt of a positive outcome, never to have to second guess, change strategies, reverse directions. And it saved me a lot of worry through her teenage years. I knew she'd come through them unscathed. My daughter is now the happily married mother of three young children. Several years ago, I shared this story with her. After thinking about it, she said, "I see. You were able to parent to your best vision of me rather than to your fear and anxiety. It was a God-given gift and one I'll be always grateful for." Thank you.
I haven't really planned this, but I felt moved, so I'm going to trust. This is a story about Will and about Kevin. When Will was here, he told me about this grant, and he knew that I had written grants in the past, and it was for the solar system. And a part of me sensed that he was feeling restless and might be moving on. But I also knew the kinds of things that he responded positively to, if we responded positively to. So I said, well, maybe this will keep him here a little longer. So I found some other wonderful people in the congregation, such as David Spidell and all of you who helped so much. And we got the solar system. And you could see he was so proud he'd come up for with a slogan for it and everything. And it was wonderful. And then we got word that he had taken another job. And I thought, oh, it didn't work, God. Didn't work. And so before we left, he had a talk with me. We had a talk together. And he said, Jeannie, I want you to know that the decision in Winchester came down to two of us. And he was just talking about having a solar system, and we had one. And he said, that was the turning point. That's why I got the job. So I'm the reason that we lost Will. Okay? No, that might be the end of the story. But what happened was when our team started looking for ministers, pretty soon I got reports back. Guess what? This one's interested in us because we got a solar system. So I think maybe that's how we got Kevin. So anyway, what I learned from that is not to think I have all the answers when I set about trying to do something good. That's God is going to use something, even make something even better out of it. Thank you.
Good morning. So my visions, how God speaks to me, it sounds cliche when I say it. It sounds preteen, 12-year-old, 13-year-old girl. But it's deeper than that for me. God always speaks to me, has always spoken to me through horses, always. As a little girl, I had a pony that was just, my mother always spoke of her as the best sitter that my sister and I ever had, because she didn't have to worry about us. My parents were divorcing. I was probably 10, 11. And I would get on this pony and I would just go, you know, bare feet, no saddle, just dog probably with me. And it was wonderful. It was bliss. I remember the feeling in my chest. And then as an older person, you know, in my 30s, I approached my divorce. And I had this really hot horse off the track. This horse could run so fast. And we divorced 3 years into it, I think. And this particular day was supposed to be our anniversary. And I was very upset, very, very upset. And I took to my horse, literally, those words. I took to my horse. And those of you who ride know that there's just days you should not get on your horse. You shouldn't. And I went, again, no saddle, you know, no helmet, ridiculously dangerous, through this trail, and he saved me. I mean, I galloped. I tore through, crying, and honestly, I don't really even remember the ride. I remember getting home and having that same feeling when I was a kid, and I didn't know God then. I had no idea about God then. And just the bliss, the calm, the safety these animals provided me. So, but the more compelling story is the horse that I share now, the relationship I share with him. I've known God through this horse. I feel he's brought me there. We've been together 18 years. He had a disease in his eyes. So I got him when he was 4, and we were in Colorado. But he developed this disease in his eyes. When he was 7, I had his first eye taken out. So he was a one-eyed wonder horse, is what I called him. He was wonderful. But so now he has, I could talk about my horse on and on, so I don't want to take everybody's time. But he went 7 years with one eye. Then the other eye was equally as affected. So I had the second eye taken out. So he is blind, and I ride this horse daily. Again, no saddle, no hard hat, and we just go. And, you know, if you close your eyes and think about the movement of a horse, he just goes. And it's patience and acceptance and grace that he teaches me every single day. He never gave up on me. We've been through, if I laundry listed what I was with, what we've done, nobody would even believe me, because it's just amazing. And it's patience and acceptance and grace. And he just goes along. He just goes along. You know, a very wise woman, my friend here, she told me once, just imagine the possibilities with God. Just imagine. And it opens right up. You know, and that's it. This horse, I would not have kept going if he wasn't there. You know, and clearly everyone in this congregation knows about animals. You know, we loved our animals last week. I couldn't bring him here, but if anyone ever wants to meet him, I'd be happy to let you meet him. So one of my favorite scriptures is 2 Corinthians 5, chapter 5, verse 7. And it's walk by faith, not by sight. And it's powerful. So God bless you all. I hope you find it. Thank you.
Good morning. So our task is to talk about either the presence or absence of God in our lives. So I wanted to talk about when my father passed, John Hancock. A lot of you knew him. I was in Hawaii when I got a phone call from my mother and my sister saying that he had taken a turn for the worse, that he had fallen, and that he is home from the hospital and it didn't look good. And I had a trip already planned to come back here. I was gonna leave Hawaii in 3 weeks and come back here. My dad got on the phone, and we said a couple of words, and then he said, actually the last words he ever spoke to me, which I did not know that at the time, which was, take care. So I hung up the phone, and it's about the only time in my life that I actually listened carefully enough to hear the voice which said, go now. So I said, okay. I got on the phone, changed my plane ticket, spent about $600 to change it, to leave in 48 hours. This was a Tuesday, I was leaving Thursday at midnight. I had a project going, I'm a carpenter, and the side of the house was open, and it was completely a mess. So I had 48 hours to get that together, and son of a gun if I didn't. I left on Thursday night, and I arrived in Burlington on Friday night, because it takes a while to get here from Hawaii. And I saw my dad at 6. He was in bed. I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, he knew I was there. He didn't say anything, because he was already kind of past words. This was Friday night. Then on Saturday, everyone left because they'd been hanging around. He was in his apartment with my, he lived at Shelburne Bay with my mom, so that he was in his own bedroom. And so everyone left and I was his caretaker. So when I left Hawaii, I got some advice from someone who works in hospice that's saying there's four things you want to say to someone when they die. I love you. Thank you. Please forgive me. I forgive you. So I had that as a goal. And I was sitting by his bed, and I held his hand. And eyes were closed, and he hadn't spoken for I don't know how long, but not to me. So I said three of them. I said, thank you. I love you. Please forgive me. And when I said, please forgive me, he had his left hand and he took my hand and he went like this. He pulled my hand to him. And that was the last thing he ever said to me. I couldn't bring myself to say, I forgive you, because I couldn't. So that was Saturday. He died Sunday morning at 4:30. So it was about 12 hours later. And we were all there in his room, and I was asleep on the floor and just coming out from a dream, and my mother said, that's it. And he was dead. So there was a bunch of kids and grandkids, and my sisters and my brother were there, and my mother. And we just kind of celebrated. It was 4:30, and we had to wait for the nurse to come at 6:30 to pronounce him dead and then do all that stuff. And so I, at one point, laid down on the bed next to his body, and I felt it growing cold. And it's so interesting that when a person dies like that, their body grows cold from the extremities toward the trunk. So I was laying there. It wasn't for very long. It probably seems a bit weird, but it didn't seem at that time. And I felt his hands and his feet and his ankles and his wrists and his arms growing cold. And his trunk was still a bit warm. And I really got the message that the only difference between being alive and dead is our breath. We come into this world and we take an inhale, and that's our first inhale. And then we go through our lives and we inhale and we exhale, we breathe and we breathe and we breathe, and we do all the other things that we do. We do good things, we do horrible things, we say wonderful things, we say horrible things, we treat people well, we treat people badly, we do all of these things. And then we have one last exhale and we're done. And that has helped me to be a better person, to remember that we're all just here doing our thing as best as we can. And we have one thing that separates us from the dirt, and that is our breath. Thank you.
So back in 2010, I was a UCC delegate for this church and went to the Vermont conference, and we had to choose some workshops, and I saw a very interesting workshop, and that the name of it was, I don't know the whole name, but anyway, the gist of the workshop was talking about helping women who have been incarcerated get back on their feet when they come out of jail. So I went to that workshop because that really was a topic that interested me. And when I got there, there were all these people in the room who felt like they all knew each other and that they were all talking amongst themselves. And I was listening to the speaker, and then at the end of the workshop, the people came over to me, the other people in the workshop came over to me and said, "Would you like to join us for lunch? We would like, you know, you seem like you're very interested in this." And we're a group of people that have been coming to these workshops and have a lot of interest as well. So I had lunch with them. We had lunch with the speaker. It was lovely. And I told them a little bit about myself. And then they said that there was a group of people in the state that a prison justice sort of group of people who come and they meet down in Randolph at the UCC building down there. And we have meetings and we talk about certain things that have gone on, and people share some of their stories about who they are, about incarcerated women. And I didn't really have any stories to share at the time, but I learned a lot from those people. And then they were telling, I had told them I was a teacher and I was and been working with kids for a long time. And so they had said, "Oh, well, we have a camp for incarcerated kids whose parents have been incarcerated, and it's a camp called Camp Agape." So I said, interesting. I'm a teacher, I work with a lot of kids. That camp sounds really interesting. How can I sign up? So they gave me the information, and I spent a week as a counselor at this camp with these kids, and it was so moving and so wonderful. The kids were fabulous, and they all just had wanted to share stories with me. And when they couldn't sleep at night, they would come over to me and say they wanted to talk to me, and we would go outside the cabin, and they just wanted to share however they were feeling with me at the time. And so I had a really, really powerful week at that camp, and came back all excited in the church. And I was telling Will at the time that I had such a powerful experience, and I did share my experience from the Camp Agape with the congregation. And then after that, I went back and did a couple of more meetings with the prison justice, and then found that I really wanted to be a mentor to a woman who had been incarcerated, because I'd been with the children, and I've been a mentor before. I'm a mentor for a girl through the King Street Center, and we've been matched for a long time and have had a great relationship, and that's another story. But anyway, so I found through this group, the Mercy Connections, which is a group you have to go through training to be, if you are interested in having somebody be a mentor to a woman that's been in jail. So I went to went through the whole workshop. It was a 5-week workshop. It was very, very, very powerful. And by the way, I felt like God was with me this whole time as I was going through all of these different steps to become this mentor to this woman. So I forgot to say that part, but anyway. So I went through the training, and then I got a call from the director, and she said, "Well, we have a woman we think you'll be a good match for. She's just gotten out of jail, and she's trying to get back on her feet." And so we met at a coffee shop and had a cup of coffee, and she was telling me her story and telling me what her goals were and what she wanted to be doing. And I just listened to her, and as it turns out, I worked a little bit with her to help her fill out some forms that she needed filled out for to be able to find temporary housing, because her big goal was to eventually get to move back to with her family, but she needed temporary housing and needed to stay and follow work with the probation officer for a little bit. So she and I and the probation officer worked for a little while together to help her get to her goal of moving back to out of state to be with her family. And I still hear from her, and she's gotten herself back together with her kids and with her family, and she thanked me, and she and I have sent emails back and forth. But then I got a call a couple of weeks later asking from the volunteer coordinator saying, well, Emily, we're extending our program now to people who are still needing to serve a little bit of time in jail before they can get out. Are you interested in working with a woman in jail who's close to getting out, but not quite yet? And I said, sure. And so, of course, that created a little bit of anxiety for me going into a jail, which I'd never done before, but I was, willing to do that, and knew that I wasn't going to be alone because they had somebody from Mercy Connection. The volunteer coordinator went in with you, so you weren't by yourself. So anyway, long and short of it is, I went in the first time and met with her, and she was a lovely, delightful late woman who's probably in her late 30s, and she was telling me she had 5 children, and that her a little bit about her children, and I again just listened as she talked, and she was talking the whole time, and then after our first visit, she gave me a huge hug and said, "Oh my gosh, thank you so much. I'm so glad we got matched, and I'm so happy to meet you, and I want to see you again." And so I said, sure. And so since then, I've been going to the jail to meet with her. And the first time I went into the jail, I was so a little bit anxious, and I kept hearing all these doors just slamming, and they weren't just like a regular door closing. All the doors in the place just seemed to always slam. And so at first I was a little startled, because I was like, wow, because in the middle of talking to her, a door would slam, or somebody would come out of a room into another room, the door would slam. And so now, since I'm still very much connected with this woman who's working really hard and is supposed to be coming out of jail in December. And I've been visiting usually once a week. I try sometimes not as often, sometimes maybe twice a month, but I've been connected with her. We do emailing through the jail, email back and forth on the times when I can't see her. And she now has had some good days and bad days, and a couple of the times when I visited her were not such great days, but I just was there to listen to her. And the very last time I went and visited with her, she was having a really wonderful day and was very positive and very just like, "I'm going to do this, Emily. I'm going to get out of jail. I'm going to see my kids. I'm going to hopefully you and I will stay connected." And I said, "Absolutely, no problem. That's wonderful." And she goes, "Well, you're going to have to stay connected, because I've already told my mother and my kids all about you." I'm just like, "Oh, okay." So she gets out in December, and I'm going to still go and see her until she gets out, but I'm thinking that God is going to help me and keep our relationship going strong when she gets out of jail. So that's my story.
So thank you all very much for your openness and your sharing. And now, in gratitude for all that we have been given, the offering will be taken and received.